This is the Medicast, February 25th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 106. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the show this week. If you're a brand new listener to the show, welcome to the Medicast. Take a look over at medicast.com and check out all of the great things that are going on over there. There's links to the Medicast blog with the show notes for this episode, as well as links to the nursing show, the Medicast store, and a lot of other great information, all available at medicast.com. Of course, if you are a long-term subscriber, I want to thank you for supporting the show, for keeping in touch, for all of your questions, comments, and yes, corrections that you've sent in to the Medicast over the past few years. It's been an important part of building the community here at the Medicast. If you want to take a more active part in that community, I urge you to head over to the Medicast forums over at forums.medicast.com. Over there, you can register for free. You can upload your favorite pictures of your EMS work or things you've seen. And you can also interact with the other Medicast listeners. I get over there periodically to check on things and answer questions and queries as well. But there's a great way for you to contribute and help each other out over at forums.medicast.com. I urge you to head over and check that out. Time to jump into some of the listener email that I've gotten recently, and I'll start off with a great email I got from brand new listener Brent. And Brent is the host of the Pod Show Radio podcast. So if you want to head over to podshowradio.com, you'll check out Brent's podcast. He plays great independent music over there, and Brent is also getting ready to start his EMT program. And he was asking if I thought that a 47-year-old male jumping into the EMS field was too little too late, or maybe not too much. But I'll tell you what, I think great things of that, Brent, and I think you'll bring a lot of experience and knowledge that's going to help out not only your own practice, but also the practice of your fellow students, and you're going to turn out a good group. I just have a feeling about that. Brent also has offered to play the Medicast promo for the show, and I do appreciate that, Brent. And for the rest of you, if you'd like to download that promo, if you have a way to post that up on your website or somewhere, you can certainly do that over at the Medicast site on the left-hand side. Down under Pages, you'll see Store and Support, and you can just click on that link. There's all kinds of things in there. You can sign up for the newsletter on that page. You can go to the Medicast store, and there's a link to download the Medicast promo. Of course, you can always go over and you can add a link on your page to the Medicast. I'm in the process of putting some badges and banners together for you to do that in an easy way, and I will look forward to giving you more information on that as that page comes online. I also got an email from listener Ginger. Now, Ginger is actually Ginger Campbell, Dr. Ginger Campbell, over at the Brain Science Podcast. She's an ER physician and also does a great show talking about the different ways our brains work. And it's a really good podcast if you haven't had a chance to check it out. But one of the things that Ginger is putting together is a science podcasters blog. Now, if you are interested in maybe looking at the science podcasters blog, or you'd like to contribute your own postings, if you're interested in science and would like to participate or have a podcast of your own in the science arena, get back to me and let me know, and I will forward your information over to Ginger. You can check it out for yourself over at sciencepodcasters.org, and that will take you over to the WordPress blog, and you'll be able to check out all of the other science podcasters that are getting online there. It's just getting started, so you can check it out and head back frequently as more and more science podcasters are brought online with that program. And Ginger, thank you for listening to the show, and thank you for inviting me to participate in sciencepodcasters.org. I heard back from listener Karen, and she is the final winner that was participating in the giveaways on the big second anniversary episode. So I think I've given away all the t-shirts and all the stuff that Dan White sent in from Alliance Medical. If you haven't had a chance to do so, head over to Alliance Medical, allmed.net, and you can check out all of the great EMS and other medical gear that they have over there. I really appreciate Dan supporting the show and Alliance Medical for sending all of the goodies that I was able to give away here on the podcast for the second anniversary gala event. So that's it. And I want to thank everybody that checked in because they heard their first name and thought maybe they won, but everybody's taken care of. And I do appreciate all of your support. Stay tuned. We're going to have more giveaways over the next coming year, and definitely for our third anniversary next February. I got an email from listener Christine, who was responding back on a previous episode where I discussed overuse of trauma centers, and she just wanted to concur. She said, you know, in her service, she is expected to be making those decisions and not automatically having a knee-jerk reaction to put every motor vehicle accident patient on a backboard and send them to a trauma center. And she wanted to point out that she thinks it's good that we talk about this, and I guess we need to maybe talk about it some more. So, Christine, thanks for your email. Got two emails from sort of new listeners. One from John, who wanted to thank me for helping him and his classmates pass their EMTB class. And John, first of all, I want to congratulate you, and I want to urge you to continue listening to the show and continue in your endeavors in education in the EMS field. I look forward to hearing more from you and your classmates in the future. If the Medicast has helped you out, maybe you can show your Medicast pride. Head on over to the Medicast store and check out the t-shirts, the Medicast water bottles, and everything else over there. You can show off that the Medicast helped you pass your classes. I also got an email from listener Steve, and he wanted to talk a little bit about how he seems to see burnout as a problem in the street. Now, he's a relatively new paramedic. He's working on the street with a paramedic who's been around for some time, and he wanted to know what I felt about, you know, the different ways of doing things. Not necessarily wrong, but just different, and how to handle that. And I sent him an email back, but I think it bears a little bit of discussion by saying that we need to make sure that we're being respectful. There's a lot of people out there who have a lot more experience than we do, who've seen a great many more things, and they may have a different attitude towards different injuries because they've seen these type of things before, and they may understand that while it looks spectacular or looks like it's serious, it's not really all that serious. They've gotten some perspective on what serious really is. And maybe they have a different way of doing things. They learned something different when they were in EMT or paramedic class years ago. And that doesn't make it wrong. So maybe instead of wondering if you should jump in or say, hey, I know something new, you should ask them respectfully after the call, hey, you know, I learned this and I wanted to know, you know, what you thought about that. How did you learn what you did, and why do you do it the way you do? This is why we pair up people who are brand new with somebody who's been around for a while, because you learn how to pass a test in your EMT and your paramedic classes. But what works in the testing environment doesn't always work well in the field. And this is why we go out and make sure that we have people paired up with somebody with some experience. And that's what precepting is all about. I'll jump in now with some voicemails. First one coming in from Mark in Oregon, talking about what they do with trauma centers and overuse of trauma centers in his region. Here it is.
Hey, Jamie. My name is Mark. I'm a paramedic in Portland, Oregon. And what we do out here when you're talking about the overuse of trauma centers, instead of entering a person with a high level of suspicion that's relatively okay after a large trauma, is to take them to the trauma hospital, however, not enter them in the system, so that if there is that injury that we did miss, we're still taking them to an appropriate facility with all the doctors on standby and stuff. And we will bypass some community hospitals here that don't really have the manpower or the technology to deal with large mass multi-system injuries.
Thanks for that, Mark. I think that's a great point and a great system. Interesting. I imagine that requires some resources in the hospital triage sector, but if you've got it set up, I think that's a great program and kind of covers all the bases. So that's a good way to do things and definitely different from what I'm experienced with here. And it sounds like different from what Christine was talking about earlier. If you have something to add or something you do differently or a comment on how you handle clearing trauma patients for local or specialist centers, get back to me. Or better yet, maybe we need to start an entry in the forums over at the Medicast forums on this. Maybe somebody who's over there can start that conversation over at forums.medicast.com, and we can get everybody chiming in and really have a good discussion in that marketplace. So I want to thank you very much, Mark, for your comment. The next comment is from a listener, Joe, and I'll let Joe talk for himself.
Hello, Jamie. My name is Joe Connor. I am an EMT intermediate in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I just was going over your podcast on the Blasco Coma Scale, and you mentioned that it goes from 3 to 15. I don't know if this is a New Mexico thing or not, but here in New Mexico, if the patient's intubated, but they're still alert and oriented, they get a T for the verbal response because they can't physically speak. So technically, a patient who is unconscious, unresponsive, but intubated would actually get a classical coma scale of a 2T. I was wondering if that is effective nationwide or if that was just a New Mexico thing.
Joe, that's not a New Mexico thing. That's something I probably didn't cover in the Glasgow Coma Score episode. And you bring up a really good point. And it's important for us, just like any other monitor or assessment tool, we need to integrate it into our practice and we need to make sure that we explain discrepancies. One of those things is when we assess pupil response. Not everybody has normally equal pupils. In fact, about 17 to 20% of the population has normally unequal pupils. That means that you're not going to see these two pupils that are identical circles on either side of the nose. So you need to ask people these questions, and you need to pass that on to your center, wherever the hospital is that you leave the patient. Let them know that you recognize the pupils are normally unequal, but there's been no change, and they seem to be reacting briskly to the light response. If you'd like to comment yourself on the voicemail line and get your comment played here on the Medicast, make sure you send in your comments. You can do that by voicemail at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. For the link of the week this week, I'd like to send some link love back to our new friend Brent. You can check out his independent music show over at podshowradio.com. And Podshow Radio is a great place where you can find all kinds of good music. Brent plays a great selection of stuff over there. I urge you to check out his podcast and let him know you heard about his show here on the Medicast. Brent's a listener to the show. And, you know, Brent, I'm going to hold your feet to the fire here. I want you to make sure you keep me in touch with any good PodSafe artists that you hear, and we can get them played here on the Medicast as we wrap up each show as well. It's time now to move on to this week's look at the news, and I'll lead off with a story I found over at Medical News Today talking about poison prevention and treatment tips. And it's a good article. It'll talk about poison proofing your home, talks about different types of and methods of poisoning that require different treatments, something that we'll need to review, and I think I'll probably move this over into the tip of the week. But one of the things I heard this week through the grapevine, I get emails regularly from local poison control here in Maryland, and there is an anticipated shortage of Digibind, which is the product that actually is used when there's a digoxin toxicity from patients who have taken too much digoxin or digitalis and are also maybe their grandchildren or somebody else has accidentally taken too much of that medication. So it's important for us to be aware of different poisonings, different things going on in our region to make sure that we understand the best way to treat these people. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the tip and trick of the week, but I just wanted to lead off with that particular story. We'll move right on into the next item in the news. And first of all, I want to have a show of hands. Well, if you're driving, don't show your hands. But who out there is a trainer? Who out there is an instructor in their region or deals with training people on things like CPR or training new EMT students or new paramedics? Well, make sure you're doing the job right, folks, because they might someday save your life. I found this great story out of North Carolina where a paramedic says he's lucky to be alive because two of his EMT students were working on the squad and actually responded to him when he began to have a heart attack. And these two students used what they had been taught to take care and save his life. They responded because he was blue and not breathing at the time. They found that he had a really fast pulse in the beginning and then suddenly had no pulse. And these guys began to do correct, proper CPR, began to take all of the proper interventions, and saved their instructor's life. I don't know if this adds up to a pass on the next test, but I'll tell you what, these guys seemed to have gotten the job done, and I'm sure that he and all of the other training colleagues are very thankful that their training came through for one of their own. So it's not too often we hear something like this, and I thought it was a very interesting story. Check out the link in the show notes and you can see for yourself. The next article in the news really intrigues me, and it's because this is a topic that we've discussed here on the show at length. The topic of emergency room overcrowding, overuse of EMS services, the lack of people having primary care access here in the United States because of lack of insurance or lack of funds to provide adequate care early on. And one of the things that always seems to come up is that we need to have more urgent care centers, more places people can go, just walk in, and rather than go to the emergency room for less severe problems like sprains, like minor cuts, things that need just a few stitches and get sent home, all of that is something that can be taken care of in an urgent care setting. And so I found this article coming out of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where a paramedic there has joined up with some other investors to start up an urgent care center in his locality. Now, he has a broad level of experience. He's worked as an engineer for companies making pacemakers and defibrillators. He also works as a paramedic. And this gentleman, Dennis Penny, has said that he doesn't want to get in the way or compete with local hospitals. On the contrary, he believes that he will actually help out the local hospitals by giving them the opportunity to handle and treat the more severe cases that they should be seeing in their emergency rooms. The new urgent care center will have offer x-ray equipment. It will also provide some limited lab work. It will be able to do school physicals and will employ about 15 people in the community, including some physicians, several emergency medical technicians, nurses, and a couple of nurse practitioners. And it will be able to accept most insurance plans, or people can pay as they go. This is a great, great program, and I'm interested to see how many other paramedics and EMS providers are able to get out there and maybe set up something similar in their communities. You know, if your area does not have adequate care that provides good primary care for your community, there needs to be a way for you to get out there and get that care to the public. And I've been a proponent of this for some time. I really think there's a big hole in the way that care is provided in the United States. And one of the problems that comes about as a result of that gap is that gap ends up getting transported by ambulance or going to the emergency room far later than is necessary for a relatively simple problem. You know, they let a strep throat go and to the point where it's become a major problem or developed an abscess, and then they become a person who requires hospitalization, IV medications, when all they really needed was to be seen by a doctor or a nurse practitioner in the field somewhere in their community, get the necessary lab testing to find out what was wrong with them, and get a set of antibiotics and go home. And this is something that just isn't easy or isn't easily happening right now. So what about paramedics in other parts of the world? What are they doing? I thought I would look at this particular story because it really is an interesting look at paramedics and how they are handling similar situations in their parts of the world. This comes out of Sierra Leone, and it is a part of Africa that has particularly severe problems with slums. In the capital of Freetown, there is a paramedic there, a woman by the name of Adama Gondor, and she is a paramedic and is responsible for running a clinic in the area of Crew Bay. She's the community health officer there, and it's her job to become the head of the clinic. However, she does so with limited supplies, rarely having enough medications to do the job that she needs to do, and having to make do with what she has at hand. Sounds like a good paramedic to me. It's an interesting look at some of the other regions of the world and what some other people around deal with, such as problems like pneumonia and coughs, something we see here. Also, problems like dysentery, repeated episodes of diarrhea, worm infestation, and malaria. And she has to deal with these health problems primarily in the very old and the very young. She has to help children become more healthy and make the most out of the drugs that she's able to have. She has also received training in general health awareness and community health, and she's been able to help people deal with becoming cleaner, washing their hands. Little things like that have made a big difference. She's also had to deal with local pregnancies, and they don't have a delivery kit, so when she has to call a nurse to come and help out with the delivery, the nurse brings their own personal kit for deliveries. Something else to remember is, you know, we throw everything away, right? Everything on our units is disposable. We don't rewash a set of oxygen tubing to use on the next patient. We don't wash anything and reuse it. And yet in most of the rest of the world, in the poorer regions, they can't afford to throw anything away. So they are washing their ET tubes. They are getting solutions that do the job and making sure that they're as clean as can be. Something else to keep in mind while we're just, I opened up the wrong size nasal cannula. I'll just toss that and get the right size nasal cannula. It's time now to move into the tip and trick of the week. And this week, I thought I would look at poisonings and specifically poison control. I've gotten a lot of email this week on a couple of different things from my local poison control center. I went over and signed up for their free newsletter, and I try to stay up on what's going on in local poisoning. Sometimes they send out newsletters about regional things that change with the seasons, new plants and things that are coming into bloom that we need to watch for children eating, things like that. And it's really a great resource for me. But it's not something I've talked about here other than to mention that you can head over and sign up yourself and get your own version of the newsletter. But I think it's something that we need to touch on. How do we access poison control? How do we deal with poison control in our region? And what is the expectation of us? And what is our expectation of them in poison control? And so we're going to talk about all of those issues here as the tip and trick of the week. Poison control, at least in my region, and I'm going to talk about Maryland's poison control, but there should be a poison control center for your state or local region wherever you are, at least in the United States. And I think most of the rest of the developed world has poison control centers. When you call poison control here in Maryland, they can be brought on to our med radios. So when we're doing a consult about a poisoning, we bring poison control and our consult physician online. We're not allowed to take consult directly from poison control, but we let them have their say, and then the physician on the medical consult side of the line then says, go ahead and do what they recommend, or do this and adjust this, or whatever they want to do. But poison control is a great resource, not just there, but also in the ways that they deal with prevention of poisoning, in public awareness of poisoning, and it's important for you to have not just your Medline contact with poison control, but also understand how you can get in touch with them in general, and how your locality can access poison control for themselves. First of all, do you know the poison control phone number? In the United States, the poison control number for the entire country, at least as far as I know, is 1-800-222-1222. This is a number that you should be getting out into your community with. When you're doing local programs and daycare centers, you should be getting information that you can send home with the kids to their parents. Things like the Mr. Yuck stickers, programs that teach parents about how to call poison control on their own. Hey, guess what? Joey ate something. Do I call 911 or do I call the poison control center? Give them that resource. Yes, if it's a true emergency, they should call 911, and the poison control center will tell them, hang up and call 911. But they may be able to take care of the problem on their own, or they may find that what Joey ate isn't going to really cause them any long-term issues, and they can just go to their pediatrician. In this situation, poison control can be our friend. Not only that, but Poison Control has a ton of resources available. If you contact your local Poison Control Center, you may find that they'll be happy to send out a whole pack of pamphlets for you to distribute in your community. Keep some on your ambulance, in your unit, in your clipboard. When you go into a residence and a child's had a poisoning or a situation's developed, you can go ahead and say, hey, I want to leave this with you before we head out down the road with your child, take them to the hospital. You know, obviously this is not a major emergency situation, but if you have a situation where you're getting ready to head out the door, it's real easy to say, hey, put this in your purse, or let's leave this on the counter for you so that you can make sure that you have good resources for yourself the next time Joey eats the crayon. The other thing we need to be aware of is when we contact poison control professionally as EMS providers and we need to get that consult information, what do we do to make sure that we have the information they need in an organized fashion so that they can get the consult done and we can get treatment underway? First of all, you're going to go through your normal steps, your initial assessment. You're going to take care of any immediate life threats and manage them. This is no different than any other patient. But when it comes time that you need to talk to medical control and to poison control, what information do you need? First of all, we need to know what kind of poisoning we're talking about. Is this an ingested poison? Is this a contact poison, an inhaled poison, an injected poison? These are all different things. Did the child get bitten by a spider or a snake, or we're just not sure? All of these things fill in there. So you need to, first of all, have a handle on exactly what kind of incident you're dealing with and be able to relay that exactly to the physician and poison control officer on the other end of the radio. You also need to know some key things. How long ago did the exposure occur? How long ago? How much of the exposure was there? Now, this may be something as simple as they were in the house, the carbon monoxide alarm went off, the child is now experiencing some general lethargy, complaining of a headache, and this happened about an hour ago. They believe that they've been home for about an hour before that, or they had been asleep all night and woke up this morning with this situation. You can also relay things like the patient took a bottle full of pills. We're unsure how many pills were in the bottle. The bottle is now empty and originally contained 30 pills. And that information is all right there on the label. So you can say, this is what we know, the patient didn't take any more than this as far as we can tell, and they may have taken less. This gives the pharmacist or the person on the other end of poison control a handle on exactly what the dose is that we're looking at. You also want to be able to relay any interventions that you've undertaken already. Now, this would be things, especially for contact situations. If the patient has gotten a liquid irritant on them and we need to flush that area copiously, especially before we get them in our ambulance, if at all possible, because we do not want to contaminate our ambulance. Now, this may be anything from pepper spray to some kind of gasoline or solvent that's been poured on the skin and caused irritation. And of course, if it's a dry, powdery substance, you want to brush that powder away. You do not want to flush it with liquids, at least not initially. You want to brush the powder, if there is any, off the skin. You want to flush any liquids off the skin with copious amounts of water, and you want to relay that you have either initiated this process or have completed this process prior to your call, and let them know exactly what you've done so far. Finally, you need to have a good handle on the patient's state of mind. And I don't just mean their level of consciousness here. If this patient has done this on purpose, has ingested pills, or intentionally harmed themselves, you need to be aware of that because they may not be more compliant with any treatments down the road, and you want to make sure that you relay that information. In fact, if that is indeed the case, you may want to get on your med radio before the patient's in the back of the unit or do so in such a way that they can't hear what you're talking about. You want to let the poison control officer and the physician know whether you think the patient's going to be compliant with any treatments. And this is especially true for things like charcoal, where you're going to have to get them to drink that liquefied activated charcoal, and it's hard to do in the first place, and it's going to be much harder to do if this person does not want treatment. So these are things you're going to relay. The other side of that is if they are altered in mental status, if they do have other side effects, you want to relay that information as well, because clearly we can't have somebody who might compromise their airway drinking activated charcoal, and this is something we need to keep track of as well. Once you've relayed all this information, let them ask your questions, get clarification, and then respond with their suggested treatments and profile. They will also likely tell you some things you should be looking for as far as anticipated side effects. And if they don't, I would go ahead and ask them. Just simply get on there and say, what else do I need to be looking for? Is there anything else I should expect to see as far as the way this patient presents? And they may tell you no. They might complain of a stomach ache, or they might complain of this. Or they may say, no, you need to be aware that this patient could go into seizures at any moment. This is important information back from them to you, and it enables you to be prepared for anticipated next steps in treatment. You might want to get your NARC box out. You might want to be prepared to deal with a seizing patient. You might want to make sure you have IV access established. All of these things can come about when you are better informed from poison control. So that's a quick look at how to interact with poison control. And I would urge you also to get in touch with your local poison control agency or your training officer and let them know that you'd like to learn more about poison control and what information they are specifically looking for and how that works within your protocols. The other thing is, find out if they have a newsletter, either a mailed newsletter or something that you can get by email, all of which is a great way to find out what's going on out there in your community and keeps them in touch with you and you in touch with them. If you don't have access to a newsletter within your poison control, I urge you to get in touch with your local poison control, your local training officer, find out how poison control works within your system of protocols, and then get some training on it. Get in contact with them, sign up for a newsletter if they indeed have one, and if they don't, then I urge you to head over to Maryland Poison Control at mdpoison.com. Maryland Poison Control has a great set of newsletters. One's called Tox Tidbits and presents usually a single toxin a month with detailed information on what you might expect to see and presentation and treatments. And Tox Alert, which presents a single alert piece, something that's going on in the news that we need to be aware of, all available at mdpoison.com. And so if you don't have your own newsletter, you can always get the one I get here in Maryland. Great information and great resources. There's a link in the show notes to everything I've talked about, Maryland Poison Control, as well as the poisonprevention.org website. Poison Prevention Week's coming up in just a few weeks, March 16th through 22nd. Find out what your local community's doing for Poison Prevention Week this year. Time now to jump into this week's Med of the Week, and I'll be looking at the medication digoxin, and specifically digoxin toxicity. The reason being is that I found that there has been a shortage recently in Digibind. This is the substance used in the hospital to grab up digitalis in the system and get it out when people have taken too much. One of the things that's interesting about digoxin is it's been around for a long time. This medication has been used to treat heart failure and cardiac conditions for hundreds of years, earlier as an herbal remedy, but more recently, of course, as a formalized medication. One of the things with digoxin is that the levels in the blood need to be very carefully monitored, and it's not hard for a patient to experience some physiologic event that causes their body to process digoxin differently, and suddenly they have a higher level of digoxin or too low a level of digoxin. This can be affected in a variety of ways, whether it's how they clear digoxin from the system via their kidneys or whether they have some dietary supplement that they're taking that affects the way that they get rid of digoxin. All of this can be something that causes a problem. Digoxin is used to treat patients with mild heart failure, and these patients generally are looking for a way to increase the amount of ejection fraction in the left ventricle. And it improves these heart failure symptoms as evidenced by their increased ability to withstand or tolerate moderate exercise and seems to help them long term. It's often paired up with a diuretic and also paired up with an ACE inhibitor and is also used to treat things like AFib. What it will do, though, is it can cause serious side effects when it is taken in toxic levels, or when it's not working anymore, can cause a return of the heart failure symptoms, all of which can occur very quickly. Patients are usually encouraged to engage in a low-sodium diet and also to take potassium supplements or eat things high in potassium because the diuretics they are taking are going to be getting rid of the potassium in their system, and they need that potassium to assist with contractility in the cardiac muscle. What other symptoms and side effects are we looking at? Well, typical side effects include drowsiness, dizziness, lightheadedness. You may also have a patient that experiences some moderate blurred vision or a yellow tinge to their vision, and they may also get a rash from taking this medication. However, there are some serious side effects that we need to watch for. Any upset stomach or vomiting or diarrhea could be a sign of toxicity. Also, a sudden onset of a loss of appetite, swelling in the feet or hands, signs of peripheral edema, right? Also, unusual weight gain. They suddenly weigh 10 pounds more 3 days later. That's a sign of fluid shift, that they're retaining fluids. And an onset of difficulty breathing is also something to watch for. The reason we're going to be watching for these things is because we need to know that a patient is taking the medication and then associate their other symptoms with the possibility that they have become toxic related to their digitalis levels. And this is important to track because some of the medications that we give to treat the arrhythmias that may present may also contribute to an increased level of toxicity with the digoxin in their blood. And if not immediately, then certainly down the road. Medications such as amiodarone, as well as verapamil and diltiazem, can all have an adverse effect on the clearance of digoxin from a person's system. Similarly, if we were to give diltiazem to a patient because they're having uncontrolled bouts with their AFib, the digoxin's not working correctly, we can give them calcium chloride, right, to deal with the possibility that they're having a hypotensive response, and that may also precipitate an additional arrhythmia when it interacts with the digitalis because, of course, this is going to change potassium levels as well. So all of these things need to be tracked and monitored. And if you're not sure when you find that you have a patient with digitalis, this is a perfect opportunity to get online with medical control. Always treat things that you see, follow your ACLS guidelines, and treat the patient accordingly. But if you're getting an adverse response, you may want to go ahead and check with medical control on top of that. Let them know what you have going on and that this patient has taken digoxin and maybe is toxic with their dig levels. All of this can be checked at the hospital, but it's important for us to be aware of what we're looking at in the field. Again, we're looking at specific problems with toxicity. Again, those visual changes, they may begin seeing halos or rings, blurred vision. This may be a normal side effect that they experience, but if it's had a sudden onset, they may have doubled up their meds and not realized it. They got up early in the morning, took their medication, fell back to sleep, and forgot they took it, and got up and doubled up. They may have doubled up on another medication, like another calcium channel blocker or beta blocker, that has altered their levels. Again, their diuretics, anything that depletes potassium from their system, is going to change the effectiveness of the digoxin and make them more prone to experiencing arrhythmias. Again, anything that's peripheral edema, sudden weight gain, signs of fluid shift, retaining fluid, all can be signs of return of heart failure in these patients. So what arrhythmias are we expecting to see in these patients? The digitalis or digoxin works by slowing conduction across the AV node. And so you'll see P to R interval prolongation. These patients may appear to have a first degree heart block, in fact. And so you need to ask them if they have been diagnosed with a first degree heart block or if this is something that's related to their digoxin. The other thing is, because it slows conduction from the atria to the ventricles, you may actually have severe bradycardia result, or in fact, other increasingly bad forms of heart block may become evident, especially in patients who have had an undiagnosed previous AV node heart block, like second degree or even second degree type 2 heart block. These patients may progress to a complete heart block, and these patients then end up needing to have a pacemaker implanted rather than being treated with digoxin. The other side of this is that you may also find that when digoxin is used in these patients to treat things like AFib or aflutter, that these patients may actually be found to have an accessory pathway. That accessory pathway, of course, is the sign of Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. WPW is where there is this other electrical pathway to the ventricles that bypasses the normal AV node delay. And when it may not have been readily evident, it may not have been used consistently by the atria because there was this other pathway through the AV node. But once you slow that conduction down, the accessory pathway, for some reason, becomes used more frequently, and you can find that there is a sudden onset of WPW in the patient. Finally, you need to monitor them for ventricular arrhythmias. And this is related specifically to things that may show up when they have a sudden onset of hypercalcemia related to either an IV medication or an increase in dietary calcium may all be precipitating a ventricular arrhythmia, and you want to treat those accordingly. So that's a look at digoxin and digoxin toxicity here on the Medicast, and that'll conclude this week's Med of the Week. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Medicast. I want to remind you that all of the links to everything I've talked about are available in the show notes for this episode over at medicast.com. In the blog there for the Medicast, you'll find all of the show notes for this and every other episode that I've discussed here on the Medicast. While you're over at the blog, check out the other posts that I put out throughout the week. Posts on new studies and news that I want to make sure you're aware of, and you can comment directly on any of those articles. Also, remember, you can contact me here by email at podmedic@mac.com or by voicemail at 941-306-3342. Call into the voicemail line at 941-30-MEDIC, and you can get yourself heard here on the Medicast directly on the show, just like Mark and Joe did this week. Don't forget, you can participate together as a community even more over at the Medicast forums at forums.medicast.com. All of that is available directly via the Medicast site. There's a link in the upper right-hand corner of the site, and you can also get there, register for free, and start your own discussion, raise your own questions, and help contribute to answer somebody else's. A great community effort going on over at the Medicast forums. I urge you to head over and check it out for yourself, and when you get there, I'll make sure to add you as a friend when I get back and check in at the Medicast forums. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This from a great supporter of the Medicast, and this is Johanna Staley and her song, Nothing I Would Change, one of my favorites that she puts out, and a song I've played here before on the show. And I urge you to check out Johanna over at her website. There's a link in the show notes. Let her know you heard her song here on the Medicast. And also, make sure you check out her songs. There's a link also if you want to purchase her music. You can head over directly to iTunes and purchase Johanna's music there as well. Great music from a great artist and a supporter of the show. Thanks, Johanna, for your support for this and other podcasts out there. And I guess that's it for me. I'll wrap up and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Hi, this is Johanna Staley, and you're about to listen to some music from my CD, I'm Not Perfect. I want to thank you guys for making such a difference. Keep up the good work.